You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
We're really looking forward to this, which will be a challenging, informative and interesting conversation about the war in Ukraine. I will be introducing one of our hosts, Susanna Baker from the Pickwell Foundation. She is a trustee of the foundation and the director for refugee and asylum work. And Susanna will introduce our other two panellists. We're really glad here in Hot House that we are sponsored by the Pickwell Foundation. If you look around, you will see the installation they've done that draws us to focus on borders and belonging and to think about that. And of course, as we think about the questions to do with the war in Ukraine, that's a really, really powerful theme to think of. And we have this border right down the middle of our stage that just highlights those divisions. So thank you for being with us. I'm going to hand out over, without further ado, from me to Susanna, who will introduce our panel and take us forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you so much for being here today. It's going to be an absolutely fascinating conversation with Luke and Irina. So I'm just going to introduce them both to you. So Luke Harding is an award-winning British journalist, author, and longtime foreign correspondent for The Guardian, known for his fearless reporting from some of the world's most dangerous conflict zone. Harding has covered wars, revolutions, and political upheavals across the globe. He spent 4 years as The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief, during which he faced expulsion from Russia for his critical reporting on Vladimir Putin's regime. Harding is the author of several best-selling books, including Collusion, which explores the connections between Donald Trump and Russia, and Shadow State, detailing the rise of Russian cyber attacks and disinformation. His latest book, Invasion, which is here, which I can highly recommend, by the way, provides a compelling account of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, offering insight into the war's early days, its broader implications, and the human cost. Throughout his career, Harding has won numerous awards for his investigative work, and his books have been adapted into films, including The Fifth Estate and Snowden. Known for his bold reporting and storytelling, Harding continues to bring critical global issues to the forefront of public consciousness. And he also found out just today that he's been shortlisted for the Orwell Prize. Then we have Irina. Irina Krunkleton is a businesswoman from Ukraine. Irina ran a successful kindergarten in Kyiv suburb in Boryspil district before the day of the invasion. When it became impossible to stay, Irina fled with her daughter Sonia, first to Lviv, then from there to Austria, then to the Netherlands, where they applied for the Homes for Ukraine scheme visa, and finally found their way to sponsors in the UK at the end of April 22. Within a few weeks of arrival, I was privileged enough to meet Irina, and despite navigating all her own changes and settling herself and her daughter into life in the UK, she began working for us at the Pickwell Foundation as a Ukraine advisor and caseworker as part of a team across Northern Devon, where we're based. Since June 22, Irina has provided essential support to Ukrainian refugees. She's organized events and facilitated resettlement processes. Irina has also featured on BBC Radio Devon on multiple occasions, has successfully organised a sponsor appreciation evening for 130 attendees, delivered a speech at the Appledore Book Festival, which is where Irina and I first met Luke, and ran a weekly hub for Ukrainians. She's participated in a sponsor recruitment campaign and spoke at the local showing of the Ken Loach film, The Old Oak. Irina has contributed to a national conference involving the subject of what Ukraine would need once there was an opportunity to return and rebuild. Alongside the foundation's work, Irina has spent time working in local schools as a Ukrainian support teacher, working both directly with the children, but also assisting their families in adapting to the UK education system. Both Irina and Luke are first timers at Greenbelt. For Irina, it's her first time camping. Her first night last night. Next, yeah, of all the nights to have a first time camping next to some trees. I was literally on my knees all night hoping nothing would happen. But yeah, so you're both really warmly welcome to Greenbelt. So, okay, I'm going to start with Irina. Irina, we're going to start with the latest news about the invasion, the Kursk incursion. And I want to ask you, how did you feel about the recent incursion by Ukrainians into Kursk? And do events like this change the way you or Ukrainians you support view the future of the war or the prospects of returning home?
The Kursk incursion happened just 10 or 12 days ago. And before this time, for almost 2 years, we've been having a hard war. It's very difficult for us Ukrainians to survive in this war. And the Kursk incursion was some piece of hope and light for us Ukrainians that we actually can win this war one day. And we understand that our resources are insufficient. We understand that this long-term war is not in our favor, but still a Kursk incursion at it's something that we are not celebrating yet. We feel a lot of fears about how it will look further. Where will it bring us to? From the other side, we have a hope that we can, one day we will be able to exchange these lands into those occupied by Russians before. I think this gave us hope and to show Western partners that we can do things, that our strong spirit to win, to protect our sovereignty and independence is alive and strong, and we will fight.
Thanks, Irina. And now to Luke. Luke, can you tell us, this latest incursion marks a significant development in Ukraine's strategy. How do you interpret this move? And what does it signal about Ukraine's evolving tactics in the war? Adding to that, do you see it as a turning point in how Ukraine is responding to Russia's aggression? And how might it impact both military dynamics and public sentiment in Ukraine and Russia? Sorry, I've given you a lot there.
No, that's all right. Okay. And by the way, hello, everybody. Great to be here as a newbie. Not camping. But maybe next time.
Definitely.
It's a really interesting moment. I've been going to Ukraine since 2007 when I was based in Moscow as the Guardian's bureau chief. Kicked out in 2011. I was back in Ukraine in 2014 when Vladimir Putin staged this kind of shadowy, covert takeover of Donetsk and Luhansk. The war began in 2014 and obviously escalated in 2022 with Putin's full-scale invasion. But I've been between the UK and Ukraine all of that period. I mean, I got back about 3 weeks ago. I'm going back to Kiev from the front line soon, early next month. And the interesting thing is I've sort of seen everybody. I mean, I interviewed Zelensky, Volodymyr Zelensky in May. And in July, I interviewed General Alexander Sirsky, who's Ukraine's commander in chief. He's the guy who planned this secret operation. And I sort of said to him, look, I mean, he basically acknowledged that the Russians have more, that Ukrainian forces are outmanned, outgunned. They have more tanks, more armored vehicles. They have aviation. They've got very powerful air defenses. And he said, really, the only way we're going to win this is by fighting smart, by doing asymmetric measures. Actually, he said it's all about quality as well as quantity. And I said, do you have a plan? And he said, yes, we've got a plan. It's a secret. I can't tell you. Ha 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 ha. And I just thought this is what generals say when they're asked questions by nosy Western reporters. Do you have a plan? You know, what is your? And I said, when are F-16s coming? These planes that Ukraine's been seeking forever. And he said, well, I know that too, but I can't tell you. So I thought, okay, he has a plan. You know, what could the plan be? Would it involve Crimea, where Ukraine has been pounding Russian defenses? Would it be in the east, where there's been grinding, terrible war of attrition with the Russians rolling forward village by broken village? And of course, it turned out to be Kursk, which was on no one's bingo card, in the northeast of the country with this, basically, invasion of Russia on August the 6th. And we should just take a step back. This is the first time that foreign troops have been on Russian soil since the Nazi Germany invaded in 1941 in the Second World War with Operation Barbarossa, summer of 41. So this is unprecedented. It is bold. It is a gamble. It's politically embarrassing for Vladimir Putin, who is pretending that nothing is happening and is kind of ignoring all this and hoping it's going to go away. But basically, Ukraine has thrown in its best, most experienced combat units to try and take as much Russian territory as they can to form what Zelensky has described as a buffer zone. And I think there are several goals. I mean, just briefly, one is to force Russia to divert troops away from the Donetsk region where they are trying to capture this town of Pokrovsk. I've been to Pokrovsk. I've stayed in Pokrovsk. If they get Pokrovsk, they basically ruin Ukraine's logistics in the whole east of Ukraine, and it would be a severe blow to Ukraine. That's one goal. It hasn't happened, unfortunately. Other troops have been rushed in, but not from there, where the Russians are still going forward. But I think another goal is geopolitical. I mean, everyone, when this operation was planned, it seemed pretty likely that Donald Trump was going to come back as president, that he was going to win in November, that from the beginning of next year, the Americans have cut off all aid to Ukraine. I mean, I've written a book basically arguing that Trump is a Russian asset, and I'm very happy to discuss that afterwards if any of you disagree. But clearly for Ukraine, this would be a very, very difficult moment. So by having land inside Russia, it means that if Trump does come back, they have something to swap. So assuming they can hang on that long. And just one final thought, which is I think it's all about red lines. I mean, the UK, the US, then Germany, then the UK have been big donors, big contributors in terms of military and economic aid to Ukraine. But there have also been red lines, which the Biden administration has been insisting upon because they're worried about nuclear escalation. Well, I think that conversation is over. But as things stand, the Ukrainians can't use British Storm Shadow missiles. They can't use American ATACMS, long-range systems, very powerful, very accurate, on Russian military airfields. And so what they've been doing instead is they've been doing drones. You'll probably have seen pictures on the news of exploding, burning Russian oil depots, of military airfields in flames, of these kind of, you know, buzzing drones going across the Russian sky. But they're basically saying, look, we have invaded Russia. Your red lines are meaningless. Let's move on. So it's probably the most interesting moment of the war since the full-scale invasion, and no one quite knows where it's going.
Wow. Thank you. So to going from the most recent news and that dramatic end to that question, Luke, I want to take you back to those very early days of the war. And in fact, that's where your book Invasion starts, Luke. But I'm going to ask Irina first. Irina, thinking back to when the invasion first began, what were your strongest memories from those initial days? And how did those experiences shape your decision to leave Ukraine?
We had a lot of talks about the possible war. In my kindergarten with the parents, they kept coming and ask, oh, what do you think? Should we leave Ukraine now? But those talks, they sounded unreal, like we would discuss some American apocalypse movie. No one believed that might happen, even though we had our Crimea cut it in 2014. Even though that happened, but no one expected that the actual bombs will fall. We will see the explosions through our windows. We will experience the shake our windows, and buildings will ruin and people will be killed. No one expected that. So, yeah, we went through COVID, and we felt that was the biggest difficulty. We went through it, and we started feeling better with all our lives and duties. But then the morning, I remember, I saw some explosions. I thought that was sun. My mind still could not believe that it is possible in this time, in 21st century, in my life, in my country. I've done nothing. I've done nothing to provoke that, to make that happen in my life. So I saw sun through my window. I jumped out of the bed because of the blast, I think. And then I went to the bathroom and I came back to my bed again. I called my daughter, we laid in my bed and tried to fall asleep again. We didn't expect that this might come to our life. Then the next explosion, because I lived near Boryspil Airport, that's airport near Kyiv. Another explosion and then another. And then we ran to behind the second wall and I started calling my relatives. I kept asking, what's going on? And I heard this word, war, war, war. There was not war in my mind, in nowadays understanding of war, what brings war. And no one prepared me to this war threat. And I thought, oh, war, this is some kind of pause in my plans. I will just hide now. We will sort it out. And I went to my parents' house, all the TV, our phones, everyone was there, my relatives, my family, my sister's family, everyone came to my house, to my parents' house, and we were listening the news. And news were different every minute, different. They were new. And we were lost around those news. And then on the next day, we realized that Russians were on the other side of the Dnieper River in Bucha, Irpin, that was there. And I realized that I have to protect myself and my daughter. We heard about their crimes, soldiers down there, and that was so cruel. I don't want to even say that aloud, but they were very cruel with people, with men, with women. And I decided that I have to protect my daughter. I have to protect our future. No one can protect me. So that's why we decided to run to Lviv, western part of Ukraine. And it was early morning, and the day when I had to leave my house, that was the most difficult decision I made. In the evening before, I put some scotch, some paper on my windows in the house. I looked around. I said goodbye to my house. I didn't know whether I would ever see this house like it was in my memories that time. Then I tried to pack, but everything looked like very important. And from the other side was not important at all. Then I collected my small suitcase. In the evening, I asked on Facebook, does anyone know where I can go? So I didn't have any ideas, but I felt like I had to go. And to get up in the morning when the alarm started, to get up, take myself out of the bed and leave house, say goodbye to my parents. I didn't know whether I would see them again, alive or healthy. Leave my house, leave everything behind, my life, just generally, and go to nowhere. That was the thing. And knowing nothing about future or what was happening at that time, I think not many people knew how dangerous it was in Kyiv those days, because Russia planned to occupy Kyiv in 3 days. So that was
it. Thanks, Irina. That was really moving and powerful. And I can't believe I've never heard you tell that story before. And to hear it in that detail and to imagine what that must have been like, it's just impossible for you to go through that. Luke, for you, reflecting on your early days, in Invasion, you detail the initial shock of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And you, at the beginning of the book, you said that there had been peace since 1989. And you paraphrase Lenin by saying, there are decades when nothing happens and weeks when decades happen. Looking back now, what moments from the early days of the conflict stand out most vividly to you? And how do you think they shape the course of the war?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's really, as you say, it's really moving to hear Irina talk about what's happening. I mean, the conversations you had with your kindergarten parents, that was absolutely the vibe. As someone who'd lived in Russia for 4 years, I was always very pessimistic. I really thought there was going to be a full-scale attack. We didn't quite know the dimensions. We didn't know that Russian tanks would crazily roll in from Belarus through Chernobyl and past the nuclear power station. But I felt a kind of hurricane was coming. But actually, most people in Kyiv didn't want to believe it, including, to some extent, I would say, Zelensky. And the night of the invasion, I write about it, it's the beginning of my book. I walked out of my hotel. I'd been there for a few months, and there were couples having romantic meals in restaurants. There was a good busker playing the violin. There was a bad busker singing Oasis numbers. There were ladies selling tulips out of buckets. I mean, it was completely normal. And I had dinner with Andrei Kurkov, the Ukrainian novelist, brilliant guy, wonderful guy. And he's an incorrigible optimist. A lot of people by that point had left, but he was still kind of hoping that it would be okay. And he'd filled up his car, he had a plan, but he didn't think he was actually going to need the plan. And I thought it was on its way. And we had a wonderful dinner. He made Ukrainian, by the way, not Russian. And we had a few drinks, and then I hugged him and his British wife Elizabeth, and I went out into the street in the historic center of Kiev. Bear in mind that Kiev predates Moscow by about four centuries. It's a very old European civilization going all the way back to the 9th century. And I took a call from a friend of mine who was a very senior guy in the Ukrainian foreign ministry, who just said, the invasion will begin at 4 a.m. The invasion will begin at 4 a.m. And so I went back to my hotel room. I couldn't sleep. And about 15 minutes later, about 4:30, I got a call from a colleague saying it started. There were explosions that you described on the edge of Kiev. Russian tanks were on the move. Aviation was coming. And it just felt, I mean, I've done a lot of war. I've done a lot of conflicts. I was in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Georgia, but this felt like one of the 21st century's kind of big inflection points, big moments, and my mind was whirring. We went down to the basement bomb shelter, and other journalists and hotel staff kind of gathered, and I was thinking about geopolitics. I was thinking about what I was going to write for The Guardian. I was thinking about macro stuff, and then about 6 a.m., a mum came in with her two small kids, smaller than your daughter. They were about 4 and 6. And they sat on chairs opposite me early in the morning, and they started colouring in colouring books. And at that point, it hit me. And I just thought, of course I can write about international politics. But this is about people. This is about civilians. This is about families. This is about sons who are going to be killed, people whose homes are going to be destroyed. And I kind of vowed to myself, really, well, I mean, first of all, I decided I would write a book, but also to tell the human story of the war. And that's what I tried to do in Bucha, in Mariupol, in reporting from the front line. Yeah, to talk about what it means for the world order, but also to capture the voices of individuals swept up in the hurricane.
Thanks, Luke. So you've brought us nicely there from thinking about the big scale geopolitics down to individual, and it's about people. So I'm going to stay on that vein. Irina, I want to hear about your personal stories of resettlement here in the UK. So in your work helping others to resettle Ukrainians, is there a particular family or an individual story that has stayed with you? And how do you think their experience reflects the larger challenges that Ukrainians face today?
During my work, I make visits to Ukrainians who fled from Ukraine and who live with their sponsors. So from the very beginning in 2022, when I started doing this, and that was the first huge wave of Ukrainians came over. So that was forced migrants, I think. That's the people were forced to leave their houses. They forced by war. And every my visit, it took more than 2 hours. I met with them and I heard each personal story, tragedy, and they needed to discuss it. And I was also very sensitive about the war. So we talked about it. We cried together. We tried to find out ways how to survive here, what to do next. We tried to make some strategies. But generally, they were traumatized. I was traumatized. And we were talking. I remember I remember one visit, there was a lady with her son. But during my visit, she was packing gifts for her son. His birthday was next day. And she was packing and she said, oh, I'm so happy to get some money from my husband for the present. So my son will be happy even though they're apart. And her husband was at front line. So the next day she called me in tears and she said, you know, I just got the information that he died. She died that day when we packed gifts from him. And I saw the emptiness in her son's eyes. And I know that, yeah, he's still surviving from migraines and he's in the UK in school. That is their tragedy. Then I saw other Ukrainian ladies nowadays who are in the UK, but their husbands are on front line. They do not leave their life like other Ukrainians. Their mind, physically they are in the UK, but their mind is there. They're making all the donations. They are collecting money for, they're completely involved in life of their husbands there. They're on phone. And yes, this wait, if he didn't respond the message, or where is he now? What is he doing? That's fight, struggle, and worries. This Ukrainian ladies. Then children without father figure. These small children who are younger than 4 years. Ukraine for them is like a fairy tale, and father and Ukraine for them, this is something. Father is from fairy tale. They don't know life reality. They just see their mothers, just their smiles when they speak about the Ukraine or father. So yes, it's difficult to find one family who survive or who suffers more. Everyone has their tragic story. Every family had to force to move, leave their life. And yeah, who knows which suffers is bigger, those who left their house, those who left their husbands, those who has their house ruined or who lost their husbands. All the this traumatic suffer there.
Thanks, Rina. You've reminded me that I remember in those early days when people first started arriving quite quickly. And I remember one of the things we were asked by the arriving Ukrainians was, can you please help us organize activities for our children because we need to grieve and we need to be able to cry and to shout when they're not in the room, because we're shielding them from the pain that we feel. And you've really just reminded me of that.
Yes, yes, Susanna, I experienced it myself. And yes, we lived under the same roof with sponsors and they had my room. And when my daughter was at school, I was able to cry in front of her. I had to be strong, very much optimistic about past. Children, they had to go to school from 8:30 until 3:30 every day to be in that ceremony. They didn't know what was that about. And at the same time, they were with us, with their mothers who were not stable, who were emotionally devastated generally. And yeah, we being adults, we needed time to cry out, to save ourselves, yeah, first, and then to help our children to integrate.
Yeah. Thanks, Serena. Luke, as you've already highlighted, your reporting often highlights individual stories amid the larger geopolitical conflict, as you described in the bunker then, with the mum and the two children. Was there a particular person or story from Ukraine that resonated with you deeply or shifted your perspective on the war?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, there are so many, but there's one that sort of comes to me from a recent reporting trip, which is that I mentioned earlier on the Russians are trying to seize the city of Pokrovsk. And in February, they took Avdiivka, which was town outside Donetsk. I mean, Donetsk has been occupied by Russians since 2014, but Avdiivka was on the old front line, the pre-full-scale invasion front line. And I visited it just before, in early 2022. It finally fell in February. And the Russians have been grinding forward ever since, village by village, using aviation to kind of drop glide bombs on Ukrainian positions and then sending in small groups of infantry, 6, 8, 10 guys, most of whom are killed. Then they send another 6, 8, 10, and that's how they go forward, sort of 200 meters, 500 meters, a kilometer. And I was, sometimes I have a plan. Sometimes I go and I'll go and meet a brigade. I'll go with a press officer. We'll drive, watching out for drones, and we'll sit in a cottage and we'll look at live screen surveillance footage of the battlefield and quite often piles of bodies. And sometimes I just improvise. And on this particular late afternoon with the sun shining, this must have been in July, I went from Pokrovsk to a frontline village called Gradivka. I didn't have anyone lined up. I normally try and go and see the mayor. The mayor wasn't available. And then I thought, okay, I'll go to the school. And I went to the school. It was interesting you mentioning school. And there were a whole lot of teenagers sitting around, as teenagers do everywhere, sort of 12, 13, 14, 15. They were playing cards. They were playing a popular game called Fool. I don't know, you know Fool? They were playing Fool and they were laughing. Some of them were on bikes. Some of the older ones had these kind of, you know, motorized bikes. And they were all leaving. The front line at that point was about 10 miles away. And you could hear Grad missiles, you know, whooshing, that they were outgoing. And you could hear kind of rumbles from artillery. And these kids were totally insouciant, just kind of going, yeah, it's got a bit more noisy. We're going to leave in a week. And what was so tragic? I mean, I worked with a brilliant Italian photographer called Alessio Marmo, who took pictures of them, was that many of them had already fled. They'd fled in 2022. They then come back to their homes. And they were now having to re-flee. And you know, here we are in this wonderful tent talking about refugees and displaced people. Some people are multiply displaced. And so their homes are being chewed up. And the reason I think about this is Gradivka, there is fighting there now. The Russians entered the village yesterday where I was. Just a small village with a shop and a street and a school. They're rolling forward. The village is falling. And they're going to kind of keep going. And I just think about their young lives. You know, they talked about wanting to go to university, wanting to study, wanting to have a normal future. And that's not possible because of this war. So much loss, people grieving for loved ones, but also grieving for futures that are being turned black.
Thanks, Luke. Both of you have just come back from Ukraine. So, Irina, can you give us a sense of, well, your experience there? How are your family? How are your friends? What does your region look like now? What's life like? Help us to understand that, having just been.
This time, so the war's been for 2 years. So this time I came to my parents. They live in the Kyiv region. And I went out to the garden and I saw tomatoes, pepper, blue sky, green grass, everything like it was before. And I was so confused. Okay, I don't understand. Why am I there? Why I'm not here? Life looks like normal. The same grass, the same sky, the same house, the same parents. People outside, they go to work, or I heard cars driving. And then that night, I fell asleep. And I woke up, just jump out of the bed because of the explosion again. And then I felt very scared. And that time I realized why I'm in the UK. Because I tried to hide, but I thought, okay, the window is on this side. So how can I hide from window? And then mirror on this side. And the roof is above me. So what could I do? I could do nothing. I just laid in bed again and I started thinking fatalistic. Okay, if it's my destiny to be killed now, then this is my destiny. And this is the mood of majority Ukrainians. So we're strong to win, but from the other side, we're very much became fatalistic. And people leave here in sirenas. People do not often go to basement in the night. You can't survive if you have 2-3 sirenas during a day, and at night you can't wake up, keep waking up your children and going downstairs or hide them every night and back and forth from the other side. If something happens with your child, you will never be able to forgive yourself for not doing action. And this behind, so from that night I started feeling fear, noises or something. So that time I'm not used, my parents and people who live in Ukraine, in Kyiv still now, they got used to this type of life with sirenas. Oh, that happened, that explosion last night. They bomb almost like Russia bombs Ukraine. Every night they send drones or missiles. They can operate missiles. Some of missiles are ballistic, that we hear sirena after the explosion, so the radar system will not able to catch the signal on time. So this is the reality nowadays in Kyiv. It's very provocative.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I was just going to add that the thing is that we have to be clear that the Russians are doing a kind of campaign of terror against the civilian population. So it's not just against military targets. They bomb pretty randomly, pretty chaotically. And sorry, do you want to come back?
Oh, come on, dear.
That's what I was going to talk about. Yeah. So I was there literally a few hours after they hit a children's hospital, Akhmedet. And you'll remember those images of kids suffering with cancer attached to drips being taken out of the shelter and on the street, just surrounded by rubble. And I went to see the children's hospital after it got smashed. It was completely ruined. There was a medical clinic as well, which was hit at the same time or a couple of hours later. And I talked to a woman, interviewed her for The Guardian, who survived that. She was going in to go and see her gynecologist. The woman to her left was dead. The doctor to the right lost his legs and was dead. She survived. The whole world went dark as this missile went through the roof. And this is what's going on. I mean, it's a sort of collective punishment terror campaign to make Ukrainians give up, to remind them that Russia is all powerful. And it's cruel, it's unrelenting. More than 600 children have been killed since the beginning of the full-scale invasion. Thousands of civilians have died or been wounded. I mean, it's interesting you talk about fatalism. I mean, I don't get out of my bed normally. I just kind of lie there and hope for the best, which is probably the wrong thing to do. But the problem is, if you spend every night in the shelter, you then can't sleep and you can't function. I can't write my stories. You can't do your stuff. It's impossible. And this is the dilemma that everyone faces in Kyiv and in other Ukrainian cities. Yeah, they're not right next to the front line, but you hear this ominous buzzing. I mean, these drones sound like mopeds. Imagine a really shonky Italian moped flying in the sky. That's what the drone sounds like. And it signals death. And everyone finds a way of trying to deal with this, but it's not easy.
I just remembered my sister, she told me this phrase, "Oh, Irina, if you can hear the missile flying, then it's not yours." That means that it flew away, so it didn't land where you are. So when I heard that, I had goosebumps and this is the reality. And of course, this terroristic regime, they try to seed, to put Ukrainians in animal fear. This is how they try to break us, to put the fear, not only military, look, just people, just inhabitants.
We are only a few minutes away from going to the floor to ask questions, so get those lined up and ready. We have so much more to talk to you both about, but I'm going to skip to some questions about looking ahead to the future. So, Irina, can I ask you, as someone who has lived through the war and now helps others to resettle, what do you think we should be focusing on in the coming months and years to better support Ukrainians, both here and in the UK and at back home?
I think Ukrainians will continue coming running away from Ukraine because Russia ruined electricity plants and the winter is coming and it will be cold, it will be dark. And those who think about future, their children's future, their kids' future, they will have to relocate. And yes, we have a little bit of experience in that. And my work is always about searching new things because life changes very fast. And yes, when Ukrainians come, they have different levels of, yes, language understanding of language. They have different... So there are different steps of integration and we have to support them. And what can we do? Yes, compassion. Yes, to support them in every like essential life duties. We just continue to acknowledge that there is a war and it's important to stop it one day as soon as possible.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that, just to add to what Irina is saying, there's a lot of talk about Ukraine fatigue. I mean, I don't feel it. I mean, you guys are here. It's extremely important that we don't kind of change the channel. I mean, this is the biggest war in Europe since 1945. The outcome will determine whether we have a system where authoritarian states, you know, powers, autocrats can roll over other countries or whether there's, I mean, it's not perfect, but this kind of law-based international system, which kind of worked in the post-war years, whether that continues and whether countries... people can be democratic, whether sovereignty exists, whether self-determination exists, whether the right to speak your own language exists. But we haven't talked about the way Russia's been trying to de-Ukrainize Ukraine, ban the Ukrainian language, burn Ukrainian books, erase Ukrainian history. There's a great campaign of falsification and kind of dark myth-making going on. So my plea to you would be to just, you know, read the news, engage. I mean, talk to Ukraine. If you're lucky enough to meet Irina or people like Irina, talk to them, ask them about their experiences, because this is going to be a long war. It's not going to finish this year. I think it won't finish next year, but in some way it's our war. Actually, it's not just Ukraine's war. It's a war for decency, for basic values, for the right to be the way you want to be.
That feels like a really good place to leave it for the minute. And we will open up for questions if anyone has questions for Irina or for Luke. Now is the moment.
Hi, thank you very much. Thank you very much for that. Particularly to Luke, you've worked in Russia and Ukraine for a long time. Do you have a feeling for what's going on inside Putin's head? And do you foresee an outcome to the war?
It's a great question. I mean, I spent 4 years in Russia, and I'm not a Putin whisperer per se, but I mean, nor am I a psychologist, but he's a sociopath. Actually, he's a very strange, small person who, like all dictators, is surrounded by sycophants and has been for a long time in a really, really delusional place. I mean, what he is doing within his own parameters is rational. There's a sort of logic to it. But essentially, we've seen so many incarnations of Putin. We've seen Putin flying with cranes, scuba diving, you know, riding. You remember the horse with his top off, riding bareback. And you know, writing the book. I mean, the most dangerous Putin that we've seen so far has been amateur historian Putin, and he had a very bad pandemic. You'll remember. The defining image of late Putin is a small man at one end of a very long table, 10 meters long, with someone else at the other side. He's terrified. He's actually a very cowardly person, terrified of being ill. And he spent 2 years just reading books and convinced himself that Ukraine, Russia and Belarus were a single cultural, spiritual sort of, you know, Christian place. I mean, Christianity has, or Orthodox Christianity, misinterpreted. There's quite a lot of that there. And that he was the person who was going to restore great Russia, make Russia great again. And it was this great messianic task which he had to pursue. And clearly it's a crazy prospectus, but he acted upon it. And then plotted the invasion. And to answer your question, the problem is that Putin won't stop until he's stopped. He believes he can win. He believes he can face down the West, that we will grow tired of the war, that, you know, today's politicians will be swept away tomorrow, which is what happens in democracies, and that he will prevail, not beautifully, but through sheer, grinding, terrible force and volume. And 500,000 Russian soldiers have been killed or wounded. 500,000 already. That's way more than the whole Soviet misadventure in Afghanistan, which went on for 10 years. So he thinks he's going to win. And there's no point in trying to cut a deal with him or negotiate or appeal to his better nature. The only way to stop him is through military force. And so the corollary of all that is that there's no point in trying to understand Putin. We just have to stop him, and therefore we have to arm Ukraine.
Hello. We host a family from Ukraine of three generations, and the young man is 15. Well, he'd be 15 in October. I really want to know whether I should be encouraging him to continue looking at his education here and his future here.
It's a very interesting question, because those children, my daughter is 14 now, and by the day when my BRP will be expired, she will be here for 5 years or four and a half years, being in education in the UK, and then she will have to go back to Ukraine. And I'm personally not sure whether if we will stop Ukraine next year, if the war will be stopped, will Putin start over after 2-3 years in 2027? So these kind of talks we also have in Ukraine. So they will go back to Ukraine in 2026, for example, if the war will be finished, and then we will run back again. So it's difficult to predict the future and to advise, actually. So I would say some Ukrainian children to continue education here, maybe to go to college, then university, and then get in these knowledges and Western life views and understanding, then come back to Ukraine and rebuild it. That would be good. But it's very individual. Thank you.
Being an immigrant or an asylum seeker or a refugee in this country is probably quite difficult at the moment. What's your experience, Irina, of being an immigrant in this country?
I experienced a lot of kindness, compassion, understanding and support. I would say from the government level to charity organizations, to my colleagues, to my neighbors, people were so supportive, understanding and helping. They try and they are doing this still. They help. They help in all sorts to find job, to help with children, to enroll children to schools. This my experience, and I provide support for Ukrainian refugees in Northern Devon. We support as much as it possible, and they are okay. So, and one important thing is to create communities, Ukrainian communities and hubs, and that what we've done also with Pickle Foundation, to organize Ukrainians together, and then we can speak, we can help each other, and we can exist as a community for who knows how long, for some period of time, hopefully not long period of time. Thank you.
Okay, I mean, I'm particularly interested in the present situation in Ukraine. Once a month since the war began, I've been visiting the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Cathedral in London. They do the liturgy in English once a month. So I've talked to people there. A question I have is, what do you see the future is for Russia post-Putin? He's not going to live forever.
That is his plan, actually. That is his plan. They're investing a lot in nanotechnology, not because they're great scientists, but they wonder whether this will prolong their lives a little bit longer. There is no succession plan. I mean, there are a number of clones. I don't know if you've seen the photos which were on social media this week. There was a Putin that went to Chechnya. There was another Putin that went to Azerbaijan. There was a Putin that held a meeting in Moscow. And they all look very different, I have to say. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but the head of Ukrainian military intelligence tells me there are clones. I think probably there are clones. So even if one Putin dies, another may continue. I mean, see it as a system as well as a man. And that is the problem. The problem is, I mean, I wrote a book about Russia called Mafia State. It is a mafia state. It's a cartel. It's not really a government in the conventional sense of the word. And they have two projects, one of which is ideological, which is this project of Russian restoration, as they would see it. And the other is to steal as much money as they can. We haven't talked about this, but a lot of that stolen money was invested in London. It was laundered by British accountants. These oligarchs hired British lawyers, and so on. So we have made many kind of missteps along the way. And I would love to see a democratic Russia. I mean, one of the people just swapped in this recent Russian swap is a friend of mine called Vladimir Karamurza. He's a great guy and really the leader of the Russian opposition. But I'm afraid I think in my lifetime, I'm not going to see him as president of Russia. Propaganda works. Most Russians support the regime, either actively or passively. The regime is quite brittle, but for now it's holding fast. And I'm not sure if we're going to see a democratic Russia ever, but certainly not this year. He poisons everybody. I wrote a book about Alexander Livinenko called A Very Expensive Poison, and they are still doing it. They're still killing people. Maybe not here, but their death squads are still running around, unfortunately.
Sorry, sir.
I'm one of the people that signed up to host Ukrainians at Greenbelt last year. We have a family living with us. I'm sorry, this is going to be an embarrassing question, but one of the things that the mum who talks about so much, when she's been with us over the last 4 months, is how worried she is for her husband and for her son, who are still in Kyiv, who are expecting to be swept off the streets at any moment, to be taken to the front line, whether they want to or not. And one of her main worry is that there is so much corruption within the army that there are people being sent to the front line with no equipment. If her husband goes, her son goes, they go to the line, there's no guns, there's no ammunition, they've got no boots, and family members have to, as you were saying, Irina, raise money themselves to equip their family members. And what I'd like to know is that actually true? And B, how much do you know, Luke, Irina, do you know how much pressure is going on from Western allies behind the lines to try and get the Ukrainian government to put the money and the resources where it should be going from the aid that is coming from the allies?
Yeah, thanks. It's an interesting question. I mean, Irina will answer it as well. But I mean, there is definitely a problem with conscription. It's the problem I was talking about earlier on when I was talking about General Sirsky. I mean, Russia is so much bigger. They've lost 500,000 people. The Ukrainian figure is smaller. We don't quite know how big it is. But more soldiers are needed on the front line to replace guys who are exhausted, guys who've been wounded, guys who've been killed. And it's definitely a phenomenon that I wrote about this for The Guardian. Quite a lot of men are hiding. They won't go out. They don't go to restaurants. They don't go to cafes. They're just staying at home because they don't want to fight, or they feel they haven't got the skill set for it. And the age of conscription has just gone down to 25. It was 27. So it's how do you, in a democratic society, how do you make people fight who don't necessarily want to? It's very hard. I the picture you painted at the front end is slightly bleak. Yeah, there are shortages of equipment. But they will have boots. I mean, I've just spent time with frontline units and training. That they've got quite a lot of kit. That the problem is more artillery shells, sophisticated American weapons. And what's happening now is that different brigades are advertising. There's a kind of internal competition saying, look, we'll look after you. We will not treat you like cannon fodder. We will train you. We will equip you. And some of the more successful units are attracting new people. So it's complicated. Some people don't want to fight. Others have just joined up. Others, you know, get called up and they're kind of okay with it.
Yeah, this is absolutely correct, what I wanted to add to Luke. Absolutely correct what your Ukrainian guest says. My niece's husband, he is at front line, and we collected, so he got something from the government. Something was not correct size, something was not according to the season, but then we collected money and asked about donations to buy some equipment for him, and that was some type of survival equipment for soldier, and he needed, and everyone gets it themselves. This is how it is.
I'd like to go back to your your Trump comment. Is it game over if Trump wins? And what is the fundamental source of Trump's position? Is it his genuine admiration for Putin, or has Putin got compromat material on Trump?
So read my book Collusion, which was a number one New York Times bestseller. It's slightly dated now, but actually the thesis I think is true. I mean, basically, yeah, briefly, dictator worship, envy. I mean, I think he would like to have his opponents taken away and murdered. I think he would like to steal more than he stole last time. But basically, I think it's about compromising material. Do you know which year Trump first went to Moscow? Little quiz question for you. 1987. He was a property developer wanting to build in Red Square, and the KGB, via the Soviet ambassador, had him over and identified him as a kind of useful person, because he's immoral, he's greedy, he's not analytical. At that point, his sort of political ambitions were already beginning. And there was a kind of on-off cultivation of Donald Trump, which kind of booted up again in about 2012 when he made his Bertha comments about Barack Obama, saying Barack Obama was not an American. And we know from the Mueller report that the Russians were all in for Trump in 2016, and launched a big multifaceted espionage operation, hacking operation to help him win. And I think he's indebted to them. There's a book, I was tweeting about it yesterday, by H.R. McMaster, who was Trump's national security advisor, who said, I never really understood what the hold was that Putin had on Trump, but it's money, it's compromat, it's dictator envy. And for Ukraine, I think it means that Ukraine would be cut loose, were he to come back. Although I'm beginning to think this is less likely, but who knows?
I heard that Ukrainians, they speak about it, that if Trump will come, then there will be double threat for Russia and Ukraine, that Ukraine will be asked to leave those occupied territories to Russia, and Russia will be said to stop war, or Western partners will give enough of weapon or will allow use weapon on Russian territory. So double threaten for Russia and for Ukraine, and then the war will be finished. So this
if only it were that simple, but
we've only got 2 minutes left, so should we do a very quick last question? Very, very quick.
This was presented often as a simple fight of good and evil, but I'm concerned about the malign influence of American corporate power on Ukraine and its power structures and its privatizing its industries, etc., and the influence of BlackRock. And I'm wondering if, from a Ukrainian point of view, are people concerned about the influence of that on their country?
I mean, in short, no. I understand your question, of course, but I think, as Irina has said so kind of wonderfully, I mean, Ukrainians are concerned about personal survival. I mean, it's existential for everybody there. They want to live, they want to survive, they want their loved ones to survive, they want their kids to be okay. They're dealing with trauma. Each time I go, I find someone else I know, or friends of someone I know, who's been killed. So they're focused, but Ukraine is a great country. I hope when there's peace, you will all come and visit it. It's a European country. It's a democratic country. And it's a place we should admire.
Yes. I imagine... I imagine that will happen naturally anyway, Luke, because there are an awful lot of incredible hosts that live in the UK who would be longing to see the homeland of the people that they have grown to love and to support over the last 2 years or so. Before we really show our appreciation for Luke and Arena, I just want to mention that Luke has another session tomorrow. When? At 3 o'clock. And he'll also be doing a book signing afterwards. After that session. So do come and hear that, because there's so much more to be brought out of Luke Harding, and so many more questions to ask him. And also we have another session in here tomorrow at 12:30, where I'm interviewing two incredible young men who have gone through the asylum system. One is still in the asylum system, and some of their reflections on that, what that has been like, including an incredible host who we affectionately call Granny Pam, who was here last year with Imran, and we showed a film of them. So you may have come to our session last year on it, and we're a year on and there's lots to say. So do come back and join us here again tomorrow at 12:30 to hear from them. And in the meantime, can you please show your appreciation for these two incredible human beings?
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.